couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new film Shazam! Fury of the Gods, Ted Lasso Season 3, Inside, Moving On, and Boston Strangler. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring The Core on 4K. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Obviously, the big news this week was the Oscars. And, I mean, for the most part, I thought it was fine. I liked the return to class that we had with the presentation and the ceremony, although I think Jimmy Kimmel's shtick got a little stupid, especially with him trying to riff with Malala. I mean, that's not her forte. She is not a comedic person. She is not somebody who does improv. So you can't like exactly send Cocaine Bear after her in the middle of the ceremony. But for the most part, things went well. There were no streakers. There were no slaps. All the names of the winners were announced correctly. So it kind of went off without a hitch. And, you know, congratulations to Everything Everywhere All at Once for winning, what was it, like 7 Oscars? And they swept all the big 6 categories with the exception of Best Actor, because Brendan Fraser won that, but they didn't have anyone nominated in that category. But all the ones in terms of the big nominations that they were on the board for, they got. And that's impressive. And I mean, it's such a sweet speech by Ke-Huy Quan, who won for Best Supporting Actor. And, you know, I mean, it was just kind of neat to see him on stage giving Harrison Ford a hug. And there's Steven Spielberg, who was shut out. He didn't win anything. And he was happy as a clam to watch Short Round and Indiana Jones reunite on stage. So, I mean, overall, I thought it was fine. I know I predicted All Quiet on the Western Front to win, but you know, there was a period of time during the ceremony that people were like, oh my God, is this actually going to pull an upset? It didn't. But that shows that that was a strong movie as well. But overall, I mean, I think the Oscars were fine. I mean, the viewership was up a little bit, but not by much. I mean, it was up like 12% from last year, but it's still under 20 million. The days of 40 million viewers plus watching the Oscars are long gone. And that's just because there's so many other options. I mean, back then, you know, 10 years ago, you had options like the internet and cable television. Well, now you've got the entirety of streaming. So the 3.5-hour award ceremony, I think, is still a little bit much to expect people to sit through. Now, the next piece of news I want to talk about is more or less an opinion. This isn't really a review as much as I want to comment on the last episode of The Mandalorian. Not as much about the episode, but people's reaction to the episode. Now, if you ever aren't following Mandalorian, The Mandalorian has a certain tone to it. And this last episode had a side story that was very similar to some of the stuff that was going on in the TV series Andor. And I know there are some people out there who love Andor, who think it's the best series and it's Star Wars of the future. I wasn't a huge fan. You can go back and listen to what I have to say. I thought it was long and drawn out and boring, and everyone's like, oh, it's about character development. I'm like, well, yeah, if they're developing by just sort of sitting there and staring at a wall. And I didn't like a lot of the characters. I found them unappealing people. I didn't find them worthy of having a hero status on there, which compared to like Rogue One, you can have imperfect characters in that, because Rogue One is the closest connective tissue you're going to get to Andor. But at least Rogue One, I felt that the people I could get behind, I just plain did not like the characters in Andor. I'm like, look, if you like Andor, that's great. Watch Andor and be excited for the second season. But I've said this many times in the past, the Star Wars universe is big enough for multiple stories, and it's big enough for multiple types of stories. What irritates me is, for as much as some people complain about the toxic fan base of Star Wars, they're just as toxic, because they're like, ew, why are we dealing with so much nostalgia? Get off of Tatooine. I don't like this stupid sort of crowd-pleasing explosions and bringing back all these characters from the previous films. If you don't like that, don't watch it. Watch Andor, watch season 2 of Andor, and hope they do more episodes and more shows like Andor. But don't change an existing show like The Mandalorian to make it more like Andor. Let the people who like The Mandalorian enjoy The Mandalorian. Same thing with like the Book of Boba Fett. I know there are a lot of people out there that were like, oh, this is just nostalgia bait. Who cares? And then there's people like, oh, this is just stupid one-off action episodes. Yes, that's what Star Wars originated as. Star Wars was episodic pulp fiction. It was based on serials that were all about just whiz-bang action, and that's fine. You can have that and have your cerebral development. It's like, it reminds me of like the James Bond movies. And I love the James Bond movies. And then Skyfall came out. And I was actually a critic in town who said to me, I don't like James Bond, but I really liked Skyfall. And I'm like, well, that's a perfect reason of not to do more like Skyfall. Because what kept a series alive for 40 years, you don't just jettison that so you can make James Bond cry and have trauma and therapy and develop a character out of its own archetype. Same thing, I use it as an example of Twilight. I don't like the Twilight movies. I had to watch them all because I'm a film critic. But look, if you don't like the Twilight movies, don't watch the Twilight movies. If they made a Twilight reboot and they made it a gritty, violent, visceral piece, I would be like, oh, yeah, I'd watch it. I'd think, oh, that'd be kind of cool. But I think it's sort of betraying your original fan base that gave the thing popularity and life in the first place. I may not like the Twilight movies, but they're not for me. But I recognize that there's a fan base, and I wouldn't want them to reboot and change those movies and abandon their fan base, because then you will get nobody, because these fickle fans, they're not going to stick around through the thick and thin. And when it comes to The Mandalorian, don't abandon your original fan base just to chase a different fan base. Ultimately, I think what happened with The Mandalorian, they did a one-off episode very similar to The Mandalorian tease in The Book of Boba Fett. This is just to connect the stuff. This is the Cousin Oliver episode of The Mandalorian that could eventually go and do its own series. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is coming from IFC, and it comes out on April 7th. That is Paint.
I'm always moving forward, just on to the next.
Don't let fame bring out the worst in you.
I want to taste the cheese.
How is everything?
It's good.
Good, thank
you. Great, thank you.
Hi, friends, and welcome to Paint with Ambrosia.
It takes paint to a whole new place.
You're entitled to your favorite TV show. It's what makes this country great.
This is, I think, a fictionalized version of a Bob Ross character. I love Bob Ross. I think Bob Ross was one of the most optimistic media figures of the late 20th century. I think he's great. We need more people generating some good nature out there, because right now, especially in this day and age, things are way too acerbic. And this movie's going to be a little bit of a goof, but, you know, it's kind of warm and cuddly at the same time. The next one I want to talk about is The Little Mermaid, which comes out in theaters on May 26th.
You broke the rules. You went to the above world.
A man was drowning. I had to save him.
This obsession with humans has to stop.
I just want to know more about them.
Ariel, don't!
Poor child.
I can help you. You can't live in that world unless you become a human yourself.
Is that even possible?
It's what I live for.
Overall, I think this looks good. I'm very excited for Melissa McCarthy. I think she looks like she's going to do great as Ursula. And the girl who's playing the Little Mermaid, I think she looks fine. I think she seems to be very cute and game and is going to be a compelling character to watch. My biggest hesitation on this from seeing this trailer is at times it looks like it just reshot the original animated film. And at that point, I'm like, what's the point? Because I mean, if you're just going to redo the exact same shots, are you even making another movie? So we'll see. I'm sure it's going to be better than Aladdin. I'm hoping it'll be better than Beauty and the Beast. And, you know, probably be on par with The Lion King, which I thought was fine. So we'll see what happens when that comes out this summer. Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Boston Strangler and Inside. This is a public service announcement. Manscaped now has beard products, and it's going even further with their brand new Weed Whacker 2.0. Go ahead and tell the world the leaders in below-the-line waist grooming are traveling north of your South Pole with their revolutionary grooming products. The new Weed Whacker 2.0 and their new beard line confirms that they have the best tools for your hygiene toolbox. Time for you to upgrade your game by going to manscaped.com and using our code FATGUYS for 20% off and free shipping. There's a lot of good stuff in here. You've got a beard trimmer with 20 different hair cutting lengths. You've got beard shampoo and conditioner and beard oil and beard balm all in this Beard Hedger Pro Kit. It gives you everything you need to trim everything nice. And then on top of it, you get all the little small parts, the nose hairs and the ears hair. Let's face it, hair is a great thing to have, but hair in some places is not. So check out the brand new Weed Whacker 2.0 with improved blades and skin-safe technology. Get 20% off and free shipping with our code FATGUYS at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com. And use our code FATGUYS. Always use the right tool for the right job with Manscaped. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and start talking about Boston Strangler. This is on Hulu. It was originally, I think, supposed to be a 20th Century Studios theatrical release, but they decided to pivot it to Hulu. In the film, Keira Knightley and Carrie Coon star as reporters who dig into the infamous case of murders in Boston in the 1960s.
Three women were strangled over the last 2 weeks.
You're on the lifestyle desk. You're not covering a homicide.
I think the murders are connected. Another woman was strangled. Just came over the wire.
I'm killed in the follow-up. You don't have a story.
How many women have to die before it's a story?
They just confirmed number four.
Police aren't talking. Never seen them this tight-lipped about anything.
I don't care if it's one killer or four. We're going to catch whoever did this.
What's funny is everybody probably knows or has heard the term Boston Strangler. And me being from Ohio, I it's not like something that was present even in my mind. Like I was born in the 70s. So even if infamously in Boston, there was probably still the looming dread of the Boston Strangler. But I'd always heard Boston Strangler, but I honestly never really knew the story behind it. I mean, I knew there's a bunch of stranglings happened in Boston and it was a serial killer, but that's really all I knew. Because I wasn't even born when it happened, and I was too young to kind of get that aftermath of it. I just had heard the term. So coming at this very cold, not knowing the situation, I thought it was an interesting approach. It reminds me a little bit of She Said, which obviously covers a very different element of investigative journalism and crime, but similar to that and a movie like Spotlight, it shows the journalistic process behind it. And I think that's the stuff I appreciated the most, because it showed what the reporters did to uncover what they were uncovering. And like I said, not having any sort of real skin in the game of knowing the story itself, it was neat to watch it kind of unfold, because I was unaware of the details. It does show the problem between investigating something as press and investigating something as police, and the burden of proof and the burden of accuracy and the ability to prosecute. And that's the big problem that they did run into. Is a lot of people just love to sit there and say, well, the police were incompetent on that one. And sure, it looks like, at least from the way it's presented in this film, the police made some blunders on their part. But there's only so much you can do as police and not violate people's civil rights, as opposed to just somebody asking questions because they're following up on the lead of a story. So I think it was interesting. Also, it reminds me a little bit of Zodiac, which was another sort of unsolved murder journalistic thing, but I think Zodiac is a much better film. Although, to be honest, I've not seen Zodiac in a decade and a half, probably. But this one, it's got interesting characters, and I like the spotlight on the two women who are doing the investigation, because, you know, not only is it obviously truth, but it shows the struggles that women go, because people think, oh yeah, women have been had their equal rights, but no, there was a lot of discrimination going on. You think discrimination happens now with women? My God, back in the 60s, it's like, why aren't you at home cooking for your kids? You know, and the fact that they were given the lifestyles test, they were not given serious reporting. I mean, now they get that, but that wasn't the case in the 60s. So it shows that. The other thing that bothers me about this, though, is the presentation, the cinematography. It's that trend in cinematography where everything's muted and there's no color and there's no contrast and it's dark as all get out. You can't see anything. Nobody uses freaking lamps in this movie. And the entire palette of the film looks like you're looking at it through a jar of urine or muddy water. That is how ugly this film was. And it's supposed to be the dark and the dread, but no, that is a cheap crutch of filmmaking technique. It's fine to not make it bright and colorful, but don't make it look like a fish tank that hasn't been cleaned since the 70s. The movie looks awful, and it is literally hard to watch. So, I mean, while it's a compelling look at the case and the journalistic process, the deliberately dark presentation and murky approach leaves a lot to be desired. I'm sorry, but I dock it on all that. Because the Boston Strangler, as interesting of a story as it is, looks like garbage. It kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Inside. No, not the French horror movie from like 20 years ago. There's about six people in the audience who understand that reference. Willem Dafoe stars as an art thief who is trapped in a penthouse apartment during a burglary.
Number one, go!
Okay, you got 7 minutes. Stay focused. The art in here is worth millions. Proceed to step two.
Sorry, man. You're on your own.
Come in, number three.
Help me! Get me out of here!
I don't know if this was a COVID movie. I don't know. It certainly feels like it because it's one guy in one location. There's like two or three scenes where people are in a location with each other, but pretty much it is just Willem Dafoe inside this penthouse apartment. And it's a neat setup. He's going in to steal some paintings and something goes wrong with the security system and it locks down. And the person who's supposed to be there, who lives there, has gone over to Europe for like probably months. So he shut off like some of his utilities, like the water to his sinks, so that he can't drink anything and there's no groceries. So it turns into this weird survivalist movie where he's literally in a fortress. He can't get out. And he has to find a way to survive that close to freedom. And it shows the trapped man's sanity devolving into madness. And on that note, I mean, it certainly displays Willem Dafoe's acting very, very well. I mean, Willem Dafoe, I love Willem Dafoe. I think he's a great actor. Even if it's not a great movie, he always brings something interesting to the table. And this is, I mean, it's all him because he is the star and pretty much the singular cast member. There's a couple other people in there, but it's mostly him. The setup's really good, and he's trying to basically survive on this desert island, which is a box in the New York skyline. At times, it reminds me a little bit of Castaway with Tom Hanks, where he is alone and he has to figure out how to survive. But especially when he starts really kind of going bonkers is when it does kind of get some sand in its gears. It does kind of slow down. It gets at times deliberately obtuse, and that does work against the film, mainly because that's all happening like in the third act. It's a showcase for Dafoe, and this picture manages to remain engaging in spite of some of the frustrating limitations, but it's those limitations are what make it not a perfect film and not a great film. It's just kind of like right in the middle, because even though it's only like an hour and a half, it drags to get there. It is not a movie that feels efficient. And so at times you do kind of find yourself checking your watch. But still, I'm going to give it a kind of rocks just because I thought it was a great spotlight on Defoe.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about Shazam, Fury of the Gods, and moving on. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Shazam, Fury of the Gods. Billy Batson and the Shazam family face off against ancient beings trying to take over the world.
Listen to me, Billy. The fate of your world depends on it. The daughters of Atlas are coming for you.
Children stole the power of all the gods.
Shazam!
This is very personal, Billy.
Look, I might not have as much experience as you because I'm not super old like you, but I've seen all of the Fast and the Furious movies, lady. It's all about
family! Shazam!
All right, look, I have a real soft spot for Shazam, going all the way back to when it was Captain Marvel, which is not the Captain Marvel from the Marvel Universe. Captain Marvel was created in the early 1940s. And my dad was a huge fan. He read those original Captain Marvel comics. I mean, he was a kid when they were publishing those very original Captain Marvels. And it was his favorite super character. Now, my dad's gone, so I have a soft spot and a remembrance for Shazam and Captain Marvel because it's been in my family for a long time. Now, if you don't know the story of Shazam, just the background is DC sued Fawcett Comics for Captain Marvel being too similar to Superman, and they had to stop publication. And then DC bought the rights to it in the 60s or 70s and started developing it as a DC character. Now, originally, the Captain Marvel character was a separate entity from Billy Batson. But when they changed Shazam in, I think, the 90s, they basically made them the same consciousness. And that's fine. I mean, I know they've changed that in the comic book, so I can accept that. And so in watching the first Shazam movie that came out in 2019, I thought it was fine. I thought it was a nice, fun diversion. And considering we had been given nothing but Zack Snyder's dark and depressing versions of DC, it was nice to see something with a little more lilt and a lightheartedness. And I liked it. I felt that there were some problems with it and there were some inaccuracies, but I liked that first Shazam movie. So I was kind of excited for this one. And boy, was I disappointed. Here's the thing. The problem with this movie is it feels like it just borrows everything from another superhero movie. Like they have a whole scene where the villains go into a museum and go in for an artifact. Well, we've seen that in stuff like Black Panther and Wonder Woman 1984. And then there's like a scene where it's a bridge is collapsing. So we how many times have we seen the bridge disaster and everything from Fantastic Four to X-Men to even Rise of the Planet of the Apes, which isn't even a superhero movie. And of course, then they're dealing with these bad guys played by Helen Mirren and Lucy Liu are stealing their powers. Well, how many times have we seen superheroes lose their power in part two? I mean, you got Superman 2, you got Spider-Man 2, even Iron Man 3, for a certain degree, deals with that. And every single thing that happens in this movie just feels derivative of another one. That's oftentimes a better film. But I think my biggest problem is the goofiness of this. I like the lighthearted take in the first movie, because I thought that captured what it was like for, you know, like a 15-year-old kid to suddenly get superpowers. But the problem is, we're several years later. I mean, the guys who play Freddie Freeman and Billy Batson are like 20 now. And they don't quite look like teenagers, but they've doubled down on their goofy craziness. And I'm like, are they like 11? No. And they say multiple times, Billy Batson makes a point to say, I'm turning 18 in a couple months. So he's essentially an adult. He shouldn't be acting like he does here. It's over the top. It's too childish. And that's partly because Zachary Levi found that he could lean into that. And he's like, oh, I'm just going to do 10 times as much in this movie. There's not even a scene that he takes anything serious. every single thing that happens, he's sort of like that whimsical, goofy kid. I'm like, is this a foster kid who's actually struggling to survive? Or are these the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? I mean, at certain times I feel that way. And they betray certain things in the original Shazam canon. The Shazam family doesn't quite gel and doesn't make sense, too, because like all of them look different. You know, each of the kids turns into a superhero that looks totally different than they, except for Mary. At no point do the foster parents go, hey, that Shazam family, they all look different. Wait, is that Mary? No, nobody does that. I don't know. It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And it just seems deliberately goofy. And then, like, they have this massive set piece with this dragon that just goes on and on and on. And the CGI, it's overdone. It reminds me a lot of Black Adam, where it's just a bunch of overblown special effects. And, I mean, look, I thought like something like Quantumania, the Ant-Man movie, Quantumania, that was fine because it was taking place in a totally different universe, quite literally. So yeah, you had crazy stuff going on, but at least they had color to this. This just turns into this gray murkiness. I was just bored with this movie. And I didn't like the characters because they seem even more immature than they were in the last film. And disrespectful too. And then on top of it, where was Mr. Mind? Literally at the end of the first movie, the end sequence, they tease Mr. Mind with Savannah. And I'm like, ooh, that's cool. That should lead to the next movie. No. Wait, well, why tease it then? That's the problem, because they said, oh, the Marvel movies always have that tease at the end. But yeah, that tease leads into the next movie. Like at the end of Iron Man 2, it leads right into Thor. The end of the first Shazam led me to believe that you're going to have this great second movie with Mr. Mind, and then you end up just getting Helen Mirren and Lucy Liu are finer from what they are, but I just didn't like the movie. I was just so bored and disappointed in it. So I'm going to have to say Shazam Fury of the Gods kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Oh, okay.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about moving on. Jane Fonda stars as a woman seeking revenge against her best friend's widower for an assault that happened 45 years ago.
Evelyn,
I need to talk to you.
About what?
I told him I was going to kill him.
I could chat. It's been 4.5 decades. Feels like it was yesterday.
You were delusional.
She told me you were cruel. So, what's the plan, Scarface?
Do you have any poison?
I have a cyanide pill. In case I'm captured by the enemy, you can have it.
This dropped in my lap literally at the last minute. I got the screener like on Wednesday, and I barely fit it in. And I'm glad I did, because I didn't know anything about this. I just seen the poster. And that is kind of fun to go into a movie completely cold. So I didn't even watch the trailer. I had no idea what it was about. And it's a very dark comedic movie, because the whole genesis of the film is Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin are going to the funeral for a friend of theirs. And the widower, played by Malcolm McDowell, apparently had sexually assaulted Jane Fonda's character like 45 years ago. And she goes in there and she's like, I'm going to kill you. And so she literally, I mean, literally wants to kill him for revenge, but it's not done in a very dark way. I mean, there's dark humor in it. And she's 100% serious that she's going to do this. And Lily Tomlin, who actually, I think, even though it's Jane Fonda's movie, I think Lily Tomlin's given a little bit more to do. I think she's a little bit more developed as a character because she's interacting with the zealot in the movie, which is Jane Fonda, who wants to kill this guy. And Lily Tomlin's character is very conflicted because on one hand, she's like, hey, you know what? What he did was wrong. But on the other hand, she's like, I don't want you going to jail. And then but on the other hand, she's like, well, but you're like 80, so who cares? You know, I mean, it's a really... There's some real interesting stuff going on with Lily Tomlin's character, even more so than Jane Fonda. But I give Jane Fonda credit because she does a good job in this movie and she commands the role better than she did in like that Samantha from Sex and the City type character you saw in like Book Club and 80 for Brady. So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting and it's darkly funny and it really hinges on these two actresses. I mean, with excellent performances by Jane Fonda and especially Lily Tomlin, this darkly comedic character study brings some uncomfortable issues to light. Because what some people think happened may not be the full story, and they may have done some horrible things because society and the world and situations would not allow somebody to stand up to him at the time. So I'm going to have to say that Moving On kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
Coming up next on Fat Guys at the Movies, I'm going to be talking about the new season of Ted Lasso and the home cinema roundup featuring The Core. Pump up the jam, pump it up. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish off the reviews and talk about the new season of Ted Lasso. It's available on Apple TV+.
That is the Ted Lasso I want coaching my team this season. The one who's willing to fight. Understood?
Yes, ma'am. You watch. From now on, I'll be floating like a butterfly and stinging like a bee. Except I won't die immediately after using my stinger. I plan to float and sting for the entirety of the whole season.
I love you guys so very much.
On three. One, two, three.
I love you guys so very much.
Great job!
Oh! Roy Kent just said great job!
The first episode dropped on Wednesday, and there's going to be a new episode every Wednesday. I think, what is it? It's a 12-week run. And this is supposedly the last season. Jason Sudeikis, who's the showrunner along with Bill Lawrence, he's always said that he kind of envisioned this as a three-season arc. And I support that. As much as I like getting more and more episodes of it, there are certain times where a show runs its course. And I think Bill Lawrence, who runs this with Jason Sudeikis, he learned with Scrubs. Scrubs overstayed its welcome by a mile. As great as Scrubs was as a show, the last couple seasons were kind of all over the place. And that was because they were dealing with people moving on, and they were dealing with canceling and moving networks and all this kind of stuff. And in reality, they should have just kind of let that go its course. At a certain point, you want characters to live their lives, and you don't want to just keep throwing drama at them. And I think that's kind of one of the reasons why they're not necessarily looking to continue Ted Lasso for 10 years. You also kind of want to go out on top. Now, they've talked about the possibility of doing spinoffs, and I think that could be potentially good. It's not the first time they'll spin off a popular series if they could. I mean, even stuff like, you know, Laverne and Shirley came off of Happy Days. But it doesn't matter what character they choose. You can develop a series based on a minor character. I mean, look at the Andy Griffith Show. It's a great example of that. It was a one-off episode on the Danny Thomas Show. And look at the huge effect that making a series out of the Andy Griffith Show, how good that turned out for television. Or look at something like more recently, you got Better Call Saul. I mean, that's always a minor character. Saul Goodman was a minor character on Breaking Bad. Very, very minor. But they've developed a fantastic show out of that one little character. So I'm curious to see what ends up happening post-season three for Ted Lasso. But in terms of the new series, I really enjoyed it. It's got the magic back. One of the things I was really worried about this, and I don't want to say too much because I've seen more episodes than have aired. But I can tell you, I feel like it's got the gang back together. They're not just browbeating you with ideas. The last season, one of the focuses was the fact that everybody deals with grief and trauma and abandonment and negative things in their lives differently. But everybody needs help. And I don't think they were overbearing on it, but that was the whole thing where Ted had to work with talking to a therapist. And they're dealing with, stuff in your past that colors and affects the way you live as a person, even as an adult. And I was a little worried that they were just going to make this show just about grief and trauma and therapy. And that, to me, wasn't what Ted Lasso is. Ted Lasso's got a very optimistic view of things. I think that's one of the reasons why it clicked so well when it premiered in the last half of 2020, because we were dealing with this pandemic, and it was just nice to see something very positive out there. But because Bill Lawrence went on and did the show Shrinking, which is all about grief and trauma, because that's the basis of the show, he's able to not focus on that here. And so what we've got, the theme, I would say, in this season is discourse and conflict and how you deal with it. And the Ted Lasso approach is a good way because Ted Lasso takes the high ground, even if it appears he's going to take the low ground. And that's what's so beautiful about it. And the other thing is it's not focused 100% on Nate Shelley. Because, of course, as we all know, in the last season of Ted Lasso, Nate Shelley quit the team, felt abandoned and betrayed by Ted, and went to go coach for Rupert's team. And, I mean, they do lay on sort of the Imperial Darth Vader motifs a little heavily on this, but it's definitely about discourse. And Nate's the one caught in the middle, but we're not dwelling on Nate. In fact, there's like, you don't see him all that much at the beginning of the season. You just know he's there. He's going to be a threat. But I do think as much as Nate is a troubled character, he's a real character. And he's dealing with real things, and he needs to overcome them. And he needs to take care of his own self-loathing before he projects that on other people. And him acting as a foil for Ted works really, really well. The season starts, Ted's son's with him in England, and he has to travel back to the U.S., and when he's at the airport, the woman at the ticket desk asks him, oh, are you ready to go back home? And he says, yes to all my toys, no to all the discourse, which I'm like, kid, you know, I follow enough people on Twitter from the UK to know that the discourse in the UK is just as bad as the discourse in the US. But they state what the theme is right at the beginning, and then they don't restate it. Ted Lasso is such a good show. It's such a wholesome show, but realistic as well. With a new focus, but that same fresh, optimistic charm, this season is rolling along as good as the others. I absolutely love it so far. So season 3 Ted Lasso totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. I'm going to be doing a vintage review this week because The Core has a 4K out in stores now.
That's an electrical superstorm.
Popping up all over the world.
I'll put this as simply as I can. Everybody on Earth is dead in a year.
The core of the Earth has stopped spinning.
The spinning core protects us from cosmic radiation.
Without it, radiation will create superstorms. Microwaves will literally cook our planet.
How could this have happened?
So, how do we fix it?
We can't. The core is the size of Mars. You're talking about jump-starting a planet.
What if we could?
And I have a certain affinity to the movie The Core. Part of it is because that came out over that summer of 2003, which was when my second son was born. There were a bunch of movies that I went to go see, and I reviewed them because I was writing reviews back then. But it was also me wanting to just get out of the house. I love my kids, but, you know, after taking care of them 24/7 for a while, that's rough. And my wife and I, and she's a teacher, you know, she had the summer off, and we were handling it together, but we each gave each other a chance. I'm like, I'm going to go see a movie, you take care of the kids. And then there are times where I'm like, I'm going to go take care of the kids, and you go to the spa or something, whatever you do to just get out and have a little bit of fresh time. And I remember seeing The Core. That was one of those movies that I escaped with. And I did that with, like, the Hulk movie, the Ang Lee Hulk movie. And this movie is, I mean, objectively, it's a terrible movie. That's the thing. It is dumb and it is stupid. And the science doesn't make any freaking sense. But there was something about these disaster films of the late 90s, early 2000s. I'm talking about movies. Independence Day, I think, kind of really kicked this off. But you had stuff like Volcano and Dante's Peak or Deep Impact and Armageddon. And you had The Day After Tomorrow and The Core is one of them. They were throwbacks to the disaster movies of the 60s and 70s. You know, Towering Inferno, Earthquake, et cetera, et cetera. I got to say, they're kind of fun. They're big and huge and over the top, but they also remind me, something like this reminds me of stuff like The Fantastic Voyage, which sort of predates those Towering Inferno type disaster movies, but it was the scientists versus nature. You know, Andromeda Strain was another one of those where, you know, the scientists are in a somewhat clinical environment. But I'm always reminded of Fantastic Voyage when I see The Core, because it is them literally going into something to try and stop it. And those are not great movies, but there's a certain warmth I feel when I see them. So I enjoyed watching the spectacle as what it was back then. And these are cool. They're stupid. And they have ridiculous things. Like, they have the line in there where DJ Qualls like, oh, so you need me to hack the planet. And they always, you know, and all the cliches. You have the stuffy professor played by Stanley Tucci. You have the dorky hacker played by DJ Qualls. You have the upstart military career person, and that's played by Hilary Swank. You have the good-looking scientist played by Aaron Eckhart. So, I mean, it's just all a load of cliches, but I enjoy these kind of movies. They still make some of these, like Moonfall or Greenland. Those, and pretty much anything with Gerard Butler in it that's not directed by Guy Ritchie. So, yeah, this is bombastic and ridiculous, but this bonkers action movie is a lot of fun as a throwback to the science versus nature thrillers of the past. I enjoy this one. I mean, it's not great, but I'd say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
And that's it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about John Wick Chapter 4. And until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.